Hello everyone, and welcome back to Murder, Mother and Me, where each week we will dive into some of the most infamous murders, mysteries and everything in between.
So if, like us, you are intrigued by all things true crime, you are in the right place.
I'm your host, Josh.
And I'm your other host, Patty. I'm the mother.
And I'm the me. Okay, welcome back to the podcast, everyone. It is a new year. We are now in 2025. So I think on behalf of both of us, we should say
Happy New Year!
Thank you for coming back and listening to us again. Laugh at stupid jokes and stupid names. We appreciate you all being here. Did you have a nice Christmas and New Year, Mum?
Yeah, it was great. It was, you know, what they say, quiet, apart from the argument over the dinner table with Jack and Angel.
As always.
What was yours like, Josh?
Yeah, I think ours was relatively chilled as well. We have a 2.5-year-old son, so as chilled as it can be with a demon child running around.
See the way I said that then? You'd think I didn't even know you, that I didn't see you over Christmas.
Yeah, I know, like we didn't spend some of it together. Okay, everyone, we're going to jump in with this week's episode, but before we do, this case takes place in 1999, and here are some interesting facts about that year.
PayPal was called one of the worst business ideas of the year. You would have thought.
That backfired, didn't it?
Badly.
I use PayPal all the time.
Me too. One of the most popular songs that year was Ricky Martin's Livin' La Vida Loca.
Can you sing us a little bit of that?
No, I'm not even going to. I'm just going to do it then as well. Kids reportedly robbed each other for Pokemon cards.
I'm not going to lie. I think, how old was I in 1999? I think I was 8. I probably would have robbed someone for a Pokemon card at that point.
You probably would. They were all over the house. Yeah, there was that little yellow one. What was his name? Pikachu or whatever his name was. Is that how you say it?
Yeah, fine. I would have robbed someone for a shiny Charizard. 100%.
What? Are there any other?
Do you know those cards now, probably that I had as a kid? They're probably worth thousands of pounds now.
Probably are.
People collect them as like collector's items.
Well, we would have been multimillionaires then because there was just packs of them everywhere.
Okay, everyone, let's get on with this week's episode. This is the case of the Columbine High School Massacre. On the morning of April 20th, 1999, in the tranquil suburban town of Littleton, Colorado, 18-year-old Eric Harris and 17-year-old Dylan Klebold carried out one of the deadliest school shootings in US history. But before we go any further, let's go right back to the beginning. As always, just a little disclaimer for this episode, it does contain graphic descriptions of violence, loss, and trauma, so please listen with caution and care. To understand the tragedy that unfolded at Columbine High School, we need to first look at the school and the community surrounding it. Columbine High School, located in the unincorporated area of Columbine near Littleton, Colorado, was a place that reflected the suburban ideal of the 1990s. The school, with around 2,000 students, was known for its academics, athletics, and active extracurricular programs. Its students came from families that had chosen this area for its reputation as a safe and prosperous place to raise children. The neighborhoods around Columbine were dotted with manicured lawns, cul-de-sacs, and family homes. But like any school, it had its social divisions, athletes, theater kids, band members, and those who felt out of place, just like Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold. While many students flourished in Columbine's vibrant environment, Eric and Dylan saw it as a symbol of everything they hated about society. So it just sounds like quite an idyllic little town, really, doesn't it? Not too much going on.
It sounds like the families that move there are just like every family today. You know, you want to bring your kids up in a better area, so you try and move to those parts of town where you think they're going to have more opportunities, better schooling, etc.
And we've not got into it yet, but it just seems like Dylan and Eric are, you know, we all have those kids at school that we think are a bit outsiders. They kind of keep themselves to themselves. They do their own little things. They have their own little groups.
I think they did mix with all the students, you know, slightly, but they saw something in each other that brought them together. So maybe this feeling of, you know, of not fitting into anything brought them together. And as per usual, you know, had they never met, maybe this tragedy would not have happened at all.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about Eric and Dylan. Eric Harris was born on April the 9th, 1981, in Wichita, Kansas. His father grew up as a US Air Force pilot, which meant the family moved frequently during Eric's childhood. Eventually, they settled in Littleton in 1993. Eric was intelligent, charismatic, and outwardly confident. Teachers described him as a good student, but those who knew him well saw a much darker side. Eric's journals and online writings revealed an intense anger at the world. He viewed himself as superior to others, and expressed a desire to punish society. He was methodical and calculated, the primary architect of the attack. Dylan Klebold, on the other hand, was born on September the 11th, 1981, in Lakewood, Colorado. He was quiet, introspective, and prone to self-doubt. Dylan excelled academically and was described as sensitive and creative by those who knew him, but beneath the surface, he battled feelings of depression and inadequacy. Unlike Eric, who thrived on rage, Dylan's writings reveal a deep sadness. He often wrote about feeling misunderstood and longing for connection. Together, their toxic friendship created the perfect storm. Eric's aggression fed Dylan's despair, and Dylan's vulnerability fueled Eric's grandiose vision of destruction. I mean, that says quite a lot, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, it certainly does. It's that age-old equation, isn't it, of these two personalities coming together. And there's, as we always say, there's a leader, isn't there, and there's a follower. And in this case, it was Eric who was the leader.
Eric was definitely the leader, and Dylan was definitely the follower. And I think, you know, leading up to this, they had wrote a lot in journals, and I believe they'd videotaped a lot of themselves talking to the camera and stuff. And it's quite clear when you watch it that he is, you know, the force driving this idea. And I think in a way, Dylan just wanted to fit in and be wanted by someone. And I think Eric made him feel that.
Yeah, it was almost like Eric empathised with Dylan. But I think his motive was otherwise, wasn't it, really? He wanted someone under his control.
The Columbine attack was not a spontaneous act of violence. It was the result of over a year of meticulous planning by Eric and Dylan. It began with small steps, fantasies of revenge against those who they felt had wronged them, scrawled in notebooks and shared in whispered conversations. But as their friendship deepened, so did their ambitions. They decided to turn their rage into a grand, destructive spectacle. The pair envisioned an attack on a scale far greater than a school shooting. Their ultimate goal was to rival the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing in terms of casualties and infamy. The attack would involve bombs to kill hundreds in the initial blast, followed by a shooting spree to target survivors, and finally a climactic showdown with law enforcement. Eric took the lead in building the weapons. He researched how to construct pipe bombs and propane explosives, documenting his progress in his journals. Over the course of months, they acquired firearms, ammunition, and bomb-making materials, often with the help of friends who were unaware of their true intentions. The pair tested their bombs in remote areas, filming their experiments as they worked to perfect their deadly designs. These videos, later dubbed the Basement Tapes, reveal the cold, calculated nature of their plans. In one clip, Eric declares, "It's going to be like fucking Doom," referring to his favourite video game.
Well, they certainly achieved the goal, didn't they, in terms of notoriety?
Well, I think this actually, if I'm not wrong, it goes down as one of the deadliest school shootings in American history, at that time at least.
I think it's what comes initially to mind when you talk about a school shooting. That name, Columbine, will always be remembered, won't it, just for this. And I'm sure it was a lovely town as well, so it's sad really, isn't it, that this is their claim to fame, really. How weird, though, to actually prepare this a year in advance and make notes about people who have done wrongs against you, you know, and you could be in that book, couldn't you, if you had a little argument with them or something. And then to construct homemade bombs, I mean, where do you even start doing that? Where'd you go for your bomb-making material? It's not Tesco, is it?
Yeah, they must have had to done a hell of a lot of research. And can we also just not forget that these are two young boys, they're 17 and 18 years old. You know, they've got so much ahead of them, they've got so much even growing up to do at that age still. How is this thought even in their head to do this?
I don't know. I think maybe if it was just one of them on their own, maybe this would not have happened. But again, I come back to that pairing up of these two specific personalities. And then even at the end, he says it's not going to be like this video game that he was playing called Doom. How much does this kind of thing influence people?
I think this is something we can talk about at the end of the story, because it does play a part,
right, okay,
in people thinking why this might have happened. I think also the fact that they had made videotapes and fully documented their entire process is somewhat scary in itself. It's like they knew from the beginning that it was going to make them infamous, and they wanted everyone to know exactly who they were and what they'd done and how they'd done it from scratch.
I think the most frightening part for me is the fact that they planned out the end with a sort of a showdown with law enforcement. They were quite prepared to die. They knew they were going to die, didn't they? And they were willing to do that, to sacrifice themselves for this grand plan and to put their name down in history books, basically.
I think they knew there was only one end to this whole scenario. they were never going to let themselves get caught and go to prison, because that kind of loses an element of the infamy, doesn't it?
I think they wanted to die, though. I think the two of them were so unhappy within themselves. It was kind of like nothing to them to... Better to go down in a blaze of glory than just fizzle out with no one knowing who you were.
Well, and go down in a blaze of glory, but also take as many people as you possibly can with you along the way.
See, I never understand that mentality. I know this is different because they say they hated society. I mean, there's always things we don't like about society, all of us, but we don't go round, do we? Like, sort of blowing things up, or... Not if you're normal, anyway.
They also planned the timing carefully. April 20th, 1999 was significant to them. Not because it was Adolf Hitler's birthday, as it's often speculated, but because it aligned with their preparations and school schedules. They chose to carry out the attack during the busiest lunch period, ensuring the maximum number of potential victims. So, it does say online, a lot of people speculate that the reason they chose April the 20th was because it was Hitler's birthday, and they kind of looked up to figures like Hitler and people of history that were infamous.
So was that purely sort of coincidental, or maybe that was a little part of it, but the main thing was that they needed a time that fitted in with their plans specifically. And they just wanted to take as many people out with them as possible. And I never understand that, you know, if you're unhappy or whatever, if you want to take yourself out, that's your business, isn't it? But to take out all of these lives with them, where does that kind of thinking come from?
I think it is just a pure coincidence that it happens to be Hitler's birthday, to be honest. I think it was more likely to be the fact that it fitted in with their school schedule, because they were still in school, still taking classes. They had a schedule to stick to, and I think it fitted in with that. And also, they picked lunchtime because they knew the cafeteria was going to be full of students, which is, you know, as it said, the busiest period.
And they took all those young lives. It was like as if they were trying to punish everybody for their own unhappiness, wasn't it?
April 20th, 1999 started like any other spring morning at Columbine High School. It was a Tuesday and students were busy with classes, lunch plans and preparations for end of year activities. For seniors, it was a countdown to graduation. But for Eric and Dylan, it was a day that they had been planning for over a year. They called it Judgment Day. At around 11:10 a.m, Eric and Dylan arrived at the school in separate vehicles. Eric parked in the junior parking lot while Dylan parked near the cafeteria entrance. They wore long trench coats to conceal their firearms and carried duffel bags filled with explosives, ammunition and other weapons. As they exited their cars, they walked casually towards the school, each carrying a backpack containing propane bombs designed to detonate at 11:17 a.m. These bombs were placed inside the cafeteria where hundreds of students were eating lunch. The bombs were intended to cause mass casualties, bringing the roof down and forcing survivors to flee into their line of fire outside. But the bombs failed to detonate, likely due to a fault in their construction. When their plan went awry, Eric and Dylan decided to start shooting instead.
What a horrible thing, though, to actually try and cause injuries to all of these people, you know, kill them, basically. But then the ones that survived, who were trying to actually get out of the building and have made it through the bomb blast, they're then standing there with whatever guns they had, some kind of automatic weapon, I'm assuming, and then to shoot them as well after them escaping.
I almost feel in a way like they wanted as many people to survive the blast as possible to try and escape so that they could just gun them down.
I think they knew there was going to be a fair number alive. I think they wanted to actually kill as many as they could, but they knew there'd be plenty left over for them to just fire at, didn't they?
At 11:19 a.m, Eric and Dylan approached the west entrance of the school, armed with a Tech 9 semi-automatic pistol, a High.995 carbine rifle, two sawn-off shotguns, and a series of homemade pipe bombs.
Where on earth did they get these weapons? I mean, this is this gun culture in America, isn't it? I mean, I know you can... Well, I don't know this personally, like, but I know you can probably acquire a gun if you really put your mind to it, or, you know, some kind of weapon. But, I mean, they're so readily available, aren't they?
Well, I think it said earlier on that they were asking friends for help and stuff to get them guns, and maybe they've said, oh, we just want to go and shoot some targets in a field, or we want to go hunting or whatever. You can kind of... say whatever you need
yeah,
to.
Yeah, but what they were doing there was, obviously there's a limit on maybe how many one person can get, so they were trying to maximise the amount of weapons they could get hold of, weren't they?
The first shots were fired at Rachel Scott and Richard Castaldo, who were sitting on the grass outside the west entrance. Rachel was eating lunch with her friend when Eric fired, hitting her multiple times. She died instantly. Richard was struck in the chest, arms and back, but survived, pretending to be dead as Eric and Dylan moved forward. From there, the pair advanced towards the west entrance, shooting at students who crossed their path. Daniel Rober, a 15-year-old freshman, was shot and killed as he attempted to flee the chaos. 15 years old.
I know these are just kids sitting eating lunch, aren't they? I can remember when I was in school and we'd sit on the grass and if it was a sunny day, and imagine someone coming at you, you just would not expect it, would you?
Sean Graves and Lance Kirkland, both 16, were also shot outside the school but managed to survive, though severely wounded. Eric and Dylan entered the school through the west doors at approximately 11:22 a.m, throwing pipe bombs into the hallway as they went. Witnesses described the scene as surreal. Smoke from the bombs filled the air and the sound of gunfire echoed through the corridors. In the main hallway, teacher Patty Nielsen encountered the gunman. She was on her way to warn students about the commotion outside when Eric fired at her, injuring her with shrapnel. Patty managed to crawl into the library where she called 911, providing one of the most detailed accounts of the attack as it unfolded. Sophomore Brian Anderson, who had been near the west entrance, was struck by the door as the gunman entered. Eric fired at him but missed. Patty pulled Brian into the library with her, saving his life. Go on, Patty.
Poor Patty. I identify with this woman.
Yeah. And I think, you know, this is a real-time 911 call that's happening as they're going through the school, shooting everything up and blowing everything up. So imagine the fear she's got trying to drag students into that library as well.
I mean, this was just a normal day, wasn't it? And then suddenly within a second, it's just changed. And you've got to think. You've got no time to plan anything. It's just your instinct, whatever you do. And it could be right or wrong, couldn't it?
11:24 a.m, chaos erupted in the cafeteria as students realised something was terribly wrong. Many initially thought it was a senior prank until they heard the gunfire and saw Eric and Dylan through the cafeteria windows. I mean, imagine that. You're just sitting there having lunch. You start hearing all these pops and bangs. And then you see two fellas, well, two kids, walking past in big, long, black trench coats. They look like something from The Matrix.
I've seen it, and the image is terrifying itself, really, just because it's surreal, isn't it? The way they looked as well.
Well, you just never expect that to happen, do you, in a school of all places?
And a lot of these students would have known them, wouldn't they? So I suppose it was that kind of, you know, feeling of like, who are these? But then you kind of recognise them as well. So it's a bit confusing, isn't it?
The propane bombs they had planted remained undetonated, but Eric fired several shots at them in an attempt to ignite the devices. The cafeteria security camera captured footage of students running for cover as tables and chairs were overturned in the chaos. So they'd obviously gone in prior to this whole attack, in previous days, to plant these propane bombs in the cafeteria. Now, my question has always been, how did they manage to do that with no one seeing them?
When you said earlier on that they pulled up in the cars and it said then that they planted them, but I'm guessing they... at other times they've done things as well. But why did no one see them do this exactly?
Well, and it also says there was a security camera in the cafeteria. Now, maybe it only covers one certain part of the cafeteria or
something. Or maybe it's only on a certain time. Maybe when the students are in there, actually. I mean, I'm guessing when they put these bombs there, what did they do? Take them in a rucksack and just put them down? Or did they conceal them somewhere, do you know? Or
I don't know. All I know is that they were hidden in places in the cafeteria.
Oh, so they were hidden.
They were hidden, yeah. And... I mean, it takes some balls, doesn't it, to go in and try and hide bombs in the middle of it. I'm guessing they tried to do it in the middle of a school day. So anyone could have walked into the cafeteria while they're trying to do it. So
I would think that the cameras would be on at that point. But maybe they just... It's so busy that people... You know, there's a lot of students milling around. And I'm sure they're not manned security cameras. I think they're just recorded, aren't they? So maybe no one just picked up on it, you know?
Well, it's a high level of risk to do that, isn't it?
Yeah, but they don't get the risk takers, aren't they?
Dave Sanders, a teacher and coach, heroically directed students out of the cafeteria, guiding them to safety. He then moved upstairs to warn others, but was fatally shot in the process. Though he survived for hours, bleeding out in a science classroom, paramedics were unable to reach him in time due to the ongoing threat.
I think that was another big issue. I think it always is in these kinds of cases. Paramedics cannot move in until it's been secured by law enforcement. And there's people literally in there dying that they can't get to. Even if the shooters, let's just say, are not in close proximity, it's if they don't know where they are and they've not annihilated that threat. That's the thing.
They have to clear the whole scene.
Yeah, and so they're not allowed to go in. And they know there's people in there, but they're just
not
allowed
to. And how sad that, you know, I would imagine that Dave Sanders probably could have survived if someone would have been able to get to him in that classroom.
Definitely, and the fact that he put his life on the line to save, which is the job of a teacher, isn't it? Your first priority has always got to be the kids. And I think it just kicks in that instinct to get them out of the way. And he's done that and he's lost his own life in the process. That is a hero, isn't it?
At 11:29 a.m, Eric and Dylan entered the library where over 50 students, along with staff, had taken shelter. It was here that the most deaths occurred, making the library the epicentre of the massacre.
And we're only now halfway through the morning. It's like, what, 11:29? So can you imagine, like, the morning starts off pretty normal. And then by mid-morning, it's just a complete massacre, isn't it?
Well, you're talking about, in everything I've described so far, we're only 10 minutes into the attack. Only 10 minutes.
And they've taken quite a lot of people down already. Yeah. Adults and kids.
The gunman entered the library laughing and shouting, "Get up." They taunted the terrified students, asking if they believed in God or daring them to move. One student recalled hearing Dylan say, "This is going to be the best day of our lives." Kyle Velasquez, 16, was the first to die in the library. He had been sitting at a computer when Eric shot him at point-blank range. Next, the pair moved through the room, firing indiscriminately and targeting students who were hiding under tables. Cassie Bernal, 17, was killed as she tried to shield herself. Her story became widely known due to reports that she declared her faith before being shot. And if I'm not wrong, I'm not 100% sure if it was Cassie, but I believe they said to someone, "Do you believe in God?" and then shot them. Which is just horrific, isn't it?
It's awful, isn't it? Just to think, just the vulnerability of them just sitting there with no warning, really. And then to do that is just like the lowest thing, isn't it?
Isaiah Scholes, 18, was hiding under a table with two friends when the gunman approached. Eric and Dylan taunted him with racial slurs before killing him. Lauren Townsend, 18, John Tomlin, 16, Kelly Fleming, 16, and Daniel Mauser, 15, were among the others killed in the library. Many more were wounded, including Patrick Ireland, who later crawled to a second floor window and was rescued by SWAT officers. So this is literally a room full of people between the age range of 15 and 18. It's literally children.
Everybody was a target, weren't they? They found a reason to kill everyone. There was no reason. They didn't need a reason, but individually, they taunted them, didn't they, with different things.
I don't think they really cared who they killed.
Never think they wanted to kill anyone. I'm just saying what they were doing was making comments to them about various things. You know?
Well, they certainly weren't just going in and just firing randomly, you know, wherever and hoping that it hit someone. They were
maximising the enjoyment of it by
exactly
making the victims.
They were taunting people and they were laughing and joking about it. And that, for me, that just makes it so much more
because
terrifying.
They were enjoying it, weren't they? That's the whole point, isn't it?
By 11:36 a.m., Eric and Dylan left the library, leaving behind a scene of unimaginable horror. 10 of the 13 fatalities occurred in this room. So that's only 7 minutes after they went into the library, which is, you know, it's not a really long time, is it? But I'm sure in the moment it probably felt like 7 days.
God, I tell you what, I'd have had it. I used to go into the library to sag off.
But the thing is, do you think that, you know, I don't know who's in these rooms or whatever, but do you think it would have been possible for people to try and fight back or at least try and overpower them, or did you just think they were too heavily armed?
There was too many weapons for one, but I think the unpredictability of this happening, do you know what I mean? They're in the library just reading a book on a computer doing whatever. Suddenly these two people appear. I mean, what could you do, really?
It's the shock factor, isn't it?
Yeah, you can't, even if you could sort of think, we're going to try and overpower them as a group, you couldn't communicate that.
You
don't
have enough time to think about it.
No time.
After leaving the library, Eric and Dylan roamed the school, firing at lockers, entering empty classrooms, and throwing bombs that failed to detonate. Surveillance footage shows them wandering through the cafeteria again, attempting unsuccessfully to ignite the propane bombs one last time.
They were determined with these bombs, weren't they? They weren't very good bomb makers, were they? Let's face it.
They were terrible bomb makers, yeah.
That was a good thing though, wasn't it?
But my thing is, why do they care now if they've gone off or not? Like, they've already killed a lot of people. I'm imagining there's no one left in the cafeteria because probably everyone's tried to get out. So what's the point? I think they just wanted to cause as much destruction in general as possible.
Yeah, I do as well. And I think it was kind of like a personal ambition, do you know what I mean? So they wanted it to work, didn't they?
Their movements during this period seemed aimless. Some experts believe they had no clear plan beyond the initial attack and may have just been waiting for law enforcement to confront them. I think that sounds about right, to be honest.
Yeah, they were waiting for the big showdown.
Well, it sounds like it says they were firing at lockers. What's the point?
Well, like
throwing
bombs
that didn't detonate. What's the point?
Like you said, it was aimlessly just killing time until till the law got there to take them out. So they thought, well, let's do a bit more damage of whatever we can do. There was no people left, was there? Otherwise, I'm pretty sure they would have been shooting at them.
Well, I assume that at this point, probably people have found hiding places and people have barricaded themselves into classrooms and all that kind of stuff. So at 12:08 p.m., Eric and Dylan returned to the library. By this point, SWAT teams were entering the school, but it would take hours before they reached the library.
Why did they go back to the library?
I think that's a question only they know the answer to.
I think it was probably the scene of their greatest achievements, and they thought, if we're gonna end ourselves, this is where.
I think you're right. Earlier on, it was described as the library was the epicenter of this massacre. So I think maybe they thought if they are gonna go, it's probably a good place to go.
Yeah, it's like when serial killers go back to places to relive their crimes, or murderers in general, you know, to get that thrill of it again. So maybe.
And also, it said that the SWAT teams were entering the school, but it would be hours before they reached the library. I guess they've got to clear every single, you know, even locker maybe, or every single room that they go past before they even get to the library.
I mean, they could literally be hiding in a locker, couldn't they, and jump out on them. But I think
well, and this is also, you know, they can't just assume that they're in the library. They might not even know that they're in the library at this point.
I think it's such a big school as well. When you see these American schools, they're not like ours, are they? Even our schools are a bit more Americanized now, the sort of senior type schools. So you can imagine that, but on a much bigger scale.
Well, it said there was 2,000 students, so that's a hell of a lot of students, which means the building must have had to be a considerable size.
And I'm guessing that as they went through the school, they're seeing casualties and dead bodies, and they're probably alerting people outside. You know, they've got to sort of take that into consideration, haven't they? And then they can't come in, as I say, until it's clear, but it would take some time, wouldn't it?
In the meantime, Eric and Dylan sat down near a set of windows surrounded by shattered glass and spent ammunition. They exchanged a few words before turning their guns on themselves. The attack was over. In just under an hour, 13 people were dead, 24 people were injured, and countless others were forever changed.
Oh, so they did kill themselves then?
So they actually did turn the guns on themselves, yeah, and I wonder why they chose that option in the end, because, you know, in their plan it was always that they were going to have this big showdown with police. I wonder what stopped them from doing that.
I'd like to say it was cowardice, but I don't think it's that, because I think it takes a lot more, well, I don't want to say guts, but you know what I mean, to turn the gun on yourself. It would have been easier to let a policeman shoot you, wouldn't it, really? But maybe it was a... I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question.
No, I think no one knows the answer to the question. And I think it is a bit of a baffling situation, because you've followed every other step of your plan. But that final step, you've decided to change that plan after planning it for a year. And, you know, we keep going on about maybe they just wanted to, you know, cause as much devastation as possible and kill as many people. Why would they not want to try and take out a few police on the way down as well?
Mm-hmm.
So I can't really wrap my head around that one. And, you know, it's really morbid, but there are pictures of the suicide scene online. And when I was researching this case, I did happen to come across them by mistake. And they're just two young lads.
I know, but two young lads that didn't have the right mindset and caused a lot of heartache and damage to other people. But I wonder if one shot the other and then shot himself.
I did think that. I wonder if they shot each other or whatever, but I actually think it's documented that it was both self-inflicted gunshots.
I think probably the reason they did that was to not give anyone the satisfaction of ending their lives. They were in control right to the last minute. Whether that was a change of plan or whether they actually decided that beforehand, I don't know. Maybe when they were in the midst of it all, they thought, you know, we're not going to let them do this and we'll do it ourselves. Because that way, no one really gets any kind of power over them, do they? I'm just trying to think of it from that point of view, you know.
Yeah, well, I think it's one last act of control, isn't it? Yeah. It's like, I'm not going to go out how you want me to go out. I'm going to go out how I want to go out.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's, especially in Eric's, from Eric's point of view, maybe not so much Dylan, but I think Dylan would have just done whatever Eric wanted him to do. So I think, you know, he has this big grandiose vision of himself, and I think he's too proud almost to let someone else end his life.
Yeah,
he has to be the one.
But so then why did they plan it like that in the beginning? But I mean, that's what they wrote in the journals and things, isn't it? I'm guessing. So that could have changed somewhere along the line, you know. Days before, couldn't it? Weeks before? We don't know, do we?
I think it's really important in a case like this to honour the victims when it's such a sad story as well. So, the 13 lives lost on April 20th, 1999 were students and a beloved teacher, all with dreams, families and futures ahead of them. Rachel Scott, 17, was the first victim. Sitting outside the school with her friend Richard Costaldo, she was shot multiple times. Rachel was known for her kindness and her strong faith. She wanted to be an actress and had a deep desire to make the world a better place. Daniel Rober, 15, was killed while fleeing the gunfire outside the school. He was remembered as a hard-working teenager who helped his father at the family business. Dave Sanders, 47, was a teacher and a coach at Columbine. When the shooting began, he courageously directed students to safety, saving countless lives. Despite being critically injured, he continued trying to help others until he succumbed to his wounds. The library saw the most devastating losses. Cassie Bernal, 17, was initially reported to have declared her faith before being shot, a narrative that inspired many. Isaiah Scholes, 18, was targeted because of his race. Isaiah was a talented athlete with dreams of becoming a comedian. Lauren Townsend, 18, was a senior and captain of the girls' volleyball team, known for her leadership and gentle spirit. John Tomlin, 16, worked part-time at a local nursery and loved the outdoors. Kelly Fleming, 16, was a shy, creative girl who loved to write and dreamed of becoming an author. Kyle Velasquez, 16, was described as gentle and loving. He was the first to be killed in the library. Matthew Ketchter, 16, was a football player with a bright future ahead. Daniel Mauser, 15, was an intelligent, quiet boy who excelled academically and loved debating important issues. Corey DePuta, 17, worked part-time at a golf course and hoped to join the Marines. Each of these individuals left behind grieving families and friends. Their stories remind us of the human toll behind the statistics. I think that's just so sad, isn't it? Especially when you know, when you just hear that there's 13 victims, one teacher, 12 students, when you actually hear about their names, their ages, and all their aspirations, it just makes it hit home even more.
The saddest thing about that to me is that you've got to sum up a life of like 15, 16, 17 years in like one sentence. And things like that where they say, work part-time at a golf course, hope to join the Marines. That's all it'll ever be now, isn't it? And Daniel, who excelled academically and loved debating important issues, he could have been a future president, couldn't he?
Yeah, and it says like with a bright future ahead and worked part-time and people had great leadership skills and there's, you know, had dreams of becoming a certain thing. And I just think all of that is just cut short because of these two stupid boys that couldn't control their emotions.
Yeah. I mean, the likes of this girl, 16, Kelly Fleming, shy, creative girl who loved to write and dreamed of becoming an author. That was literally me in school. That could have been me sitting in that library. And none of, if you think of it this way, if that had happened at my school, none of this, what we're doing now, would take place, would it? You wouldn't be here. Do you know what I mean? And that, if you look at it that way, that's how much life is lost, isn't it? It's not just one person, it's all of those offshoots that come from that person.
And you know, it also said there was 24 people injured as well, so the death toll could have been a hell of a lot higher. And I'm sure they'd hoped that it was a hell of a lot higher. But it's just, yeah, it's so sad when it kind of brings it to reality when you really hear about the people that lost their lives.
The physical damage is one thing, isn't it? The death and destruction, but the actual mental damage as well is life-altering, isn't it?
Well, as it says there, you know, all of these people had families as well. It's, imagine that now, they've had to carry on with their life without their loved ones because of this one act of, you know.
It's ripples in a pond, isn't it?
It's awful. The aftermath of the Columbine massacre was as far-reaching as the attack itself. The immediate response was one of shock, grief, and a desperate search for answers. The media descended on Littleton, broadcasting images of students fleeing the school, SWAT teams entering the building, and makeshift memorials that sprang up in the days that followed. The names and faces of the 13 victims became symbols of innocence lost, while Eric and Dylan were cast as villains whose actions defied comprehension. In the weeks and months after the attack, the Columbine community struggled to process the trauma. Survivors dealt with physical injuries, emotional scars, and the loss of friends and loved ones. Parents, teachers, and law enforcement faced intense scrutiny as people asked, could this have been prevented? The search for answers led to an avalanche of blame. Violent video games, heavy metal music, and movies like The Matrix were cited as potential influences. Others pointed to bullying, gun culture, and mental health issues. The truth was far more complex, rooted in the unique combination of Eric and Dylan's personalities, circumstances, and shared delusions. I think that's pretty much sums up what we were saying earlier about, you know, I remember I mentioned The Matrix, how they looked like they were from The Matrix, and you mentioned the video game Doom earlier.
I think all of those things you've listed, everything can influence people in a negative way. Little bits of this and that, do you know what I mean? But it takes a certain type of personality for it to influence them in that way. I think if I can listen to heavy metal music and watch movies and blah, 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 but I'm not going to go out and do it. So it's, as they said earlier on, the perfect storm.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it was a toxic combination of both of their personalities, wasn't it? I guess it was the worst bits of both of their personalities kind of merged into one action, which was this attack.
I think what was missing in one was made up for by the other. So it was like a jigsaw coming together to create this, wasn't it? But it's like what I always say, you can take any set of circumstances and sort of overlay them onto any particular person and the result will be different each time. And unfortunately with this is what happened. So I don't think you can point to any one thing, and these mental health issues and everything are relevant. But again, you know, everybody's dealing with something and don't do this kind of thing. They can have bad upbringings and everything and don't go out and commit this kind of crime.
It's definitely just an accumulation of a lot of different things, isn't it? Columbine also became a catalyst for change. Schools across the nation implemented new safety measures, including lockdown drills, metal detectors, and increased surveillance. The tragedy spurred debates about gun control and mental health that continue to this day.
And it does still go on, and yet these school shootings have got even worse, and, you know, other tragedies where
they seem
involved
to have got more frequent.
I think so. I think people of this mentality use these kind of things as a template to do go bigger and better. And they're never going to solve this problem, I don't think, anyway. When it said they implemented new safety measures, basically what they're doing is making schools prisons, really. None of this should be necessary, should it? But how do you safeguard against something like this happening?
Well, I think this is just, you know, this is a massive problem in especially in America, isn't it? Not that it doesn't happen anywhere else, but it seems to primarily always, next to always happen in America. And I think when guns are so readily available over there, you're always going to face problems like this. And it feels to me like it's not really going to change that much anytime soon.
I think we've got a similar problem here now, though, except it's knives instead of guns. So really, when somebody puts their mind to doing something, I think mostly there's no way to stop it, you know. Buying a knife here is like buying a gun there. Maybe they wouldn't do as much damage because they didn't have as much firepower, but they could still go in with a gun and shoot people anyway.
It's just too easily accessible, and it shouldn't be. Not something like a gun.
What a world, though, when you go to school and you've got to go through a metal detector, have your bag searched, blah, 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 do you know what I mean, and do all of this. It's like we're living in a prison, really, isn't
it?
Well,
even as a parent, you want to... I would never want to send my son to school fearing that he might not come home.
I don't think I thought that goes through anyone's head, but years ago... Well, not a normal thought anyway, but years ago we had the Dunblane massacre here in Scotland, which was a primary school, and a gunman went in there and shot all these little kids while they were doing PE. I mean, what... You know, how do you stop something like that happening? I remember when I used to take you to school and there was none of this, you know. But you could just walk into the playground. That's what normal people do, isn't it? Who would think that someone would go in there with a gun? You know, I mean, you didn't think of that when you take your kids to school. That's the way it should be, isn't it? But unfortunately, as I say, I think it's us that are now living in a prison because we're trying to protect ourselves and our children against people like this.
But perhaps the most enduring impact of Columbine is its place in the cultural psyche. It marked the beginning of an era where mass shootings became a recurring nightmare in American life. For many, Columbine was a wake-up call, a reminder of the fragility of safety and the importance of vigilance. In Littleton, the scars remain. The school was renovated after the attack, with the library, the site of the most deaths, replaced by a new wing known as the Hope Memorial Library. Every year on April 20th, the community gathers to remember the lives lost and reflect on how far they've come. Today, more than two decades later, Columbine remains a symbol of both loss and resilience. Survivors and victims' families have worked tirelessly to honour the lives lost. Organisations like the Rachel's Challenge Programme continue to spread messages of kindness and connection. As we close, let us remember the 13 lives lost and reflect on how we can create a safer, more compassionate world. Thank you. Right, Mum, what a way to kick off 2025 that was.
Well, I had a tear in my eye then, you know, when we were talking about that. I think it's really sad.
It is a really horrific case, and I think we were just talking about it, like, off... I was going to say off camera, but off microphone. Mm. That, like, what would you actually do in that situation? Because, like you said in the episode, you probably do look at them and you double-take and you think, hang on, I actually know... Wait, that's Eric and Dylan. And then they've got these guns and they point them at you, and you're probably still up to that point think it might be a bit of a prank or something.
I think it was the image of them, wasn't it, with these long trench coats, and one of them had the cap on backwards, and I don't know, just...
It almost looked like a bit of a costume, like a bit of a joke.
Well, I think that's what it was, wasn't it? You know, to them...
I mean, to everyone else. It probably looked like a bit of a wind-up.
Yeah, to everyone else, yeah, seeing them coming in like that, just horrible though, isn't it? The look of them as well.
It's awful.
And I've seen the still footage from where they entered the cafeteria, and even that is just so frightening, just seeing them with this big gun in the hands. You know, imagine that coming towards you while you're eating your lunch and you're just not expecting it.
Well, I think, you know, at the end of the day, I guess they both got what they wanted. They are infamous, whether we like it or not.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Sadly, they actually achieved their goal, didn't they, in this instance? Which is infuriating, isn't it?
Yeah, and this is just a case that's always stuck with me. I don't know why. Whenever anyone mentions a school shooting, this is always the first one that pops into my mind. And I think it's just, you know, the level of planning and the brutality and just them two, which I just find it bizarre and interesting.
I just think what a waste of a life. Everyone else's lives as well, obviously, but to choose to do that with your life. And again, this brings up the question of, are you born like that? Is it nature or nurture, do you know what I mean?
We ask this question every episode.
I know, but it intrigues me though, because is it something that's sort of inherent in everyone, and then it takes, as your life takes a course, it brings it out? Or is it always going to come out, you know?
Personally, my opinion is, I think with someone like Eric, who's got that like kind of grandiose vision of himself, and he thinks that he's better than everyone else.
Yeah, but why does he think that?
Well,
then?
I think that's just him. That's how he was born. I think without him, I don't think Dylan would have gone on to do something like this. I think he probably would have went on to lead quite a, you know, unfulfilled, quiet life. But I think Eric probably was always destined to do something like this or something, just based on how they describe his personality and the way he is in those videos and stuff. I can't see any other path that he would have taken. So I do believe that it is always in people, and it just takes a certain situation or a certain other person in this instance to come into your life to make it a reality.
Yeah, I think it's got to be something within you, and something can spark it, do you know what I mean, to bring it out of you, maybe. Maybe some life event or something that triggers it, I don't know. I mean, you see this all the time with kids that are brought up and they have the best upbringings. Brian Blackwell, for instance, who knows why they do these things, you know? Is there something that happens along the way that...
That's why I think it doesn't particularly matter how you're brought up or who you're brought up by.
I think it matters. I do think it matters.
I think it plays a part.
I think now and again you get, let's call them a black sheep, that just, it doesn't matter what you do, it is going to come out.
That's what I mean, I think.
I guess answers our question, doesn't it? Okay, everyone, that's it for this week on Murder, Mother and Me.
Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you again next time.
And remember, if you can't do the time, don't do the crime.